Hello and welcome to the season 8 finale of the Travel Diaries podcast. I'm your host, journalist Holly Rubinstein, and here each week I'll be speaking to a very special guest about the 7 chapters in their life's travel diaries. From their earliest childhood travel memory and the first place they fell in love with, to their hidden gem and what's at the top of their travel bucket list. We'll be uncovering their adventures around the world and the travel experiences and destinations that have shaped their lives. You may have first got to know today's guest as the bad boy of the reality TV show Made in Chelsea. Now married with 3 children to model Vogue Williams, who he met on the TV show The Jump, he regularly tops the podcast charts as a co-host of the hilarious hit podcast Spencer and Vogue, as well as entertaining listeners with his former Made in Chelsea co-star Jamie Leng on the podcast 6 Degrees from Jamie and Spencer. It is, of course, Spencer Matthews. Spencer has led a truly international life. Not many people can say they grew up in a hotel on a small Caribbean island, and it was so interesting to chat to him about life there and how it shaped who he is today. He'll be talking about his relationships with his old Made in Chelsea co-stars, and we also talk about Spencer's recent time in Nepal. Spencer's older brother Michael tragically died climbing Mount Everest in 1999, and Spencer has collaborated with Disney to make a documentary film called Finding Michael about the journey to try and find his body, which was never brought home. I think this is the first time he's spoken at length about the documentary, and I was really touched by his honesty about such a monumental experience to go through and what it meant to him and his family. In fact, Spencer has taken on a number of huge challenges that we talk about on today's episode in memory of his brother, taking him from the Sahara Desert to Arctic Sweden. And alongside that, he takes us from the south of France and Morocco to New York City and Paris and much more. So let's get started. Spencer Matthews, welcome to the Travel Diaries. It's amazing to see you today. How are you?
Holly Rubinstein, it's a great pleasure to be on this fine podcast. And I'm very well, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for being here. And I mean, I have to say, it's amazing to see you, but I am also a little bit distracted by the amazing clothes that I am seeing hanging behind you that are Your wife's amazing attire there. I'm like slightly distracted, thinking I'm very jealous.
I was about to say, don't be fooled. None of this is mine. It's all Vogue's. This is where I come for complete peace and quiet. You know, we have 3 children, as I'm sure you're aware. The house is usually full. Vogue's sister and brother are currently with us as well. So if I need total silence, the closet is the answer. Otherwise, there's no guarantees otherwise.
So obviously, I mean, looking into your life story, travel is a really big feature because you've had a really international life.
I jumped around a lot as a kid in particular. Changed schools, you know, probably more than most. Nothing to do with me, might I add. Just the family moved around a bit. You know, I grew up in Cornton, which I don't think many people will have heard of. It's a small, and when I say small, I mean like tiny town. Like, you know, every single person in the town. You can cycle around the town in 6 or 7 minutes. You know, tiny, tiny, and it's just next to Newark. And if you haven't heard of Newark, that's close to Nottingham. So, I grew up in a beautiful house in Cornton. Kind of surrounded by family, earliest memories. And then when I was very young, we moved to Paris for like a year and a half. So,
and how was that? How did you feel about that at the time?
I mean, at the time, I was far too young to care or really, I didn't even realize that what we were doing was an important move. It just felt cool and different. And, you know, I think at that age, you know, I was literally finger painting at the time. I hadn't forged any, you know, very serious relationships. I think, you know, I can remember leaving I had a couple of pals, Matthew and Nicholas, who, God, I haven't thought about them for a very long time. But obviously kind of didn't see much of them. After that, moved to Paris and made new friends with a young lady called Judith, who I remember was bouncing on, on my parents' bed one day and put purple ink all over the ceiling. This is already a big trip down memory lane. I haven't thought about kind of Paris. I went to I call it creche now. My God, my wife is Irish, as you know. So I call it creche. I went to kind of, you know, preschool over in Paris, but it was amazing. I remember walking every day to school. We could see the Eiffel Tower. We walked down past all of these beautiful little markets in Paris, just on the side of the Seine, you know, and they would sell all these kind of gemstones. And I was obsessed with fool's gold. I don't know if you remember or know fool's gold. I was just, I loved it. And kind of every so often I'd nudge my dad into buying me like a little piece of fool's gold. And I had this little gem collection. So that's kind of most of what I remember from Paris, but it was great. And I loved it. And Paris has always had a special place in my heart.
Mm. And so chapter one of your travel diaries is your earliest childhood travel memory, I guess, beyond Paris. Then what would that be?
Probably the south of France, like Antibes and Cannes. My godfather, who's just the most incredible man, I just love him. You know, those people who are just always themselves and just always kind of joyful and just generous and happy, right? Like I'm very lucky to have a godfather like him. And he lives in this beautiful town called L'École sur Loup, which is right next to Saint-Paul-de-Vence. You may have heard of Saint-Paul-de-Vence, maybe not L'École sur Loup. Saint-Paul-de-Vence is kind of famous for its art and sculptures and there's this beautiful restaurant, and the views are just fantastic. And there's this beautiful restaurant up there called La Colombe d'Or, which has original kind of Picassos running through it. I think they have 300 million euros worth of art or something on the walls. And it's the artists used to come through and doodle on stuff and napkins for food, right? So it's long before they were, well, obviously they became notorious, you know, post-death, it's when, you know, they were struggling for cash. So they would go to La Colombe d'Or and they would paint in order to eat. And the place is just full of these, well, masterpieces, I guess. So, you know, very rich, you know, artistic culture up there. And it's just a really beautiful part of the world. So I remember going to see him, you know, a lot, kind of every year. And you know, he would treat me like his son, I guess. They're just great people. So that's probably my earliest memory.
That's a beautiful memory. And then I guess on top of that, was it at around the age of seven, you then moved your life and to the Caribbean?
Again, I mean, I didn't have much to do with that.
You're like, Mum, we're moving to the Caribbean.
Yeah, exactly. Well, coincidentally, it was actually with my godfather. My parents and my godparents went sailing in the Caribbean. I don't remember the sailing, to be honest, but they arrived kind of in St. Bart's as part of their journey. Loved it. And this isn't the St. Bart's. I mean, if people are listening and they know St. Bart's, this is a very different St. Bart's, right? This is St. Bart's in 1993, I believe, and just a totally different deal to what you might know or expect now.
So what, if paint a picture of St. Bart's in 93, then what was it like?
Just completely kind of organic and just very, you know, unpretentious and very kind of behind the times almost. It was just very casual, you know, surf shacks, surfers, panini shops, you know, just, you know, cheeseburgers and chips everywhere. Just super relaxed, right? No huge wealth.
Not glitzy.
To speak of. Yeah, no big New Year's Eve parties, nothing really. It was a very local place. And, you know, tourism wasn't really big either there. You know, it was a kind of unknown gem in the Caribbean, French speaking, different to its neighboring islands, and just a really kind of interesting, lovely place to be. And at the time, there was a hotel there called the Eden Rock, and it was built by a gentleman called Remy De Hanen, who was a really interesting bloke. He used to carry a revolver and just was a proper adventurer, you know. And he was the first man to land a plane on St. Bart's. He was the first mayor of St. Bart's and was just a huge kind of lover of life, big character, had all kinds of incredible guests stay at this hotel. You know, Howard Hughes was a regular, Greta Garbo was a regular. It was amazing, right? And my parents,
a real heritage.
Yeah, it was fantastic. And my parents stayed there, and it was you know, it was four bedrooms at the time, I think, and just perhaps really not what you'd expect. Like, very beautiful, built on a rock that was protruding out of Saint-Jean Bay, and you know, fantastic, but kind of damp, you know, cockroaches, cats, you know, like, you know, it wasn't what you might think it would be. And and as time passed, my parents bought the place, and we are, you know, this is back in the day, so it's not at all, again, you know, the kind of money you might think it would be. You know, this is a long time ago, small islands, you know, no notoriety to speak of, just a beautiful, interesting property, and bought it as a house, like a place to be, and then kept it on as a hotel, and it became my parents' career, I suppose, kept it on, and it's now, you know, the Eden Rock that, I don't know, you may have heard of, or some people might know. You know, it's pretty exciting and interesting place.
One of the
most
popular hotels in the Caribbean.
It's a wonderful place, and just so much work has gone into it, and it's just grown and evolved over time so much. And it's been interesting in each of its phases, actually. You know, not one isn't necessarily better than the other. But I grew up there, right? So I grew up in the hotel. And as I said, you know, it's not like growing up in a hotel. You know, it's not how you might imagine it. It was quite different, but certainly very peculiar and you know, full of wonder and interesting things for a kid, right? It was just really exciting. And, you know, I feel like I had a probably quite a different childhood to most.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I find that so fascinating to grow up on a small island, having lived in cities prior to that. You know, were you suited to island life? Like, how did you love to spend your time there?
I think everything was, you know, interesting and fascinating at that age. You know, we had all kinds of interest. You know, we'd go to the beach, obviously. Like, you could wander out. There's very little crime in St. Barts. In fact, you know, it's said to be crime free. Leave your house keys in your car. You know, you could put your watch on the dashboard of your car, whatever. You know, it's fine.
Yeah.
So we would wander around and became, I guess, you know, independent quite early, because, you know, my parents would be perfectly happy to let us just go and play on the beach. The beach is, you know, over a kilometer long, and we'd go to the very end of it and, you know, find a cave and have fun in caves and climb hills and do whatever. It's just different to, as you say, being in a city. But, you know, I made some friends there. And then, of course, because we kept it on as a hotel, each year we would have guests come through the hotel and they would have kids. So it's kind of, there was always fresh fun to be had with you know, kids and parents alike. St. Barts is really seasonal, so it depends on the kind of holiday you're looking for. If you're looking for, you know, glamorous, glitzy parties that have incredibly interesting people, I suppose, you know, flowing out the doors, then you know, there's like a 2-week period in December that's really exciting and interesting, I suppose. If you have three kids like me, it's less interesting now at that time, although, you know, throughout my 20s, that was the place to be, I guess. You know, we are going to go in October, I think, which is far quieter. Like, the hotel's just reopened. There's, you know, the staff all have 6 to 8 weeks where they go home, and, you know, it's the down season in St. Barts, so lots of restaurants are shut. There's very few people there. We love it at that time, obviously, because, you know, it's just, you have the freedom to kind of operate, you know, however you like. And, you know, we love just heading to a beach and taking water with us and getting away from stuff, not people per se, but just being able to just relax on the beach is nice, instead of being, you know, within the hotel all of the time. But, you know, there's fantastic shopping, there's fantastic hiking, sightseeing, you know, pretty much whatever you like. There's water skiing, wakeboarding, parasailing. If you're into riding, there's horses, you know, there's all kinds of stuff. It's very difficult to be bored, I think, over there.
And you went to school there, so, and you are bilingual as a result.
Yeah. So that's something that I'm, you know, really grateful for. I remember first day of school over there, one other kid, I think, spoke English. No teachers spoke English at all. And I think I was six. So, you know, you're really thrown in the deep end, but, you know, you pick it up alarmingly quickly because you don't have a choice. Like, your brain's like a sponge at that stage, and, you know, you just retain information like nobody's business. So actually in 5-6 weeks, you're speaking French, you know, pretty
Amazing.
Well.
Yeah.
Because at least you know how to communicate. You know, you may not have all of the vocabulary, and you might get the odd tense wrong, but from communicating with people, you understand what they're saying and how they're saying it, right? It's not, I think if you were to sit down and take a French exam, you'd fail it. But, you know, communicating with somebody in front of you is becomes quite easy quite quickly. And then, of course, you build on that.
Absolutely. Well, let's pause there and move on to chapter two. And that is the first place that you fell in love with.
It would have to be St. Bart's, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I was thinking it would be.
Yeah, it kind of has to be. I mean, I still feel like it's home. You know, when the plane door opens and I step out of the plane in St. Bart's, I feel this sense of being at home.
That's so nice.
Yeah, it's lovely. And, you know, that was my first real love, you know, and it always will be, you know. And it's just fun to have kind of grown up there. So through all the different stages of my life, I've lived them there. But I've been very different people kind of growing up. I've changed an awful lot over the years. And that island will always have a special place in my heart for kind of each of those transformative periods. Yeah, yeah. You know, yeah. So it's just interesting. There's so much of my history is there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, interesting that you talk about like changing so much, because I mean, I obviously have to briefly touch on how we first got to know you on our TV screens in Made in Chelsea. At that time, you know, you were the notorious kind of bad boy, weren't you? I mean, how do you feel looking back at that time in your life? Because I know that maybe you might have like mixed feelings about it, but then at the same time, I guess it's how we all got to know you first.
Yeah, look, I often joke about, you know, I say negative things about Made in Chelsea from time to time, not to be, you know, ungrateful. I loved Made in Chelsea at the time, right? The kind of character that I played was a very conscious decision, you know, and I wanted to create drama for the show. I saw that as doing my job well, right? I never saw Made in Chelsea as being completely real, right? And I know that that's probably not what people want to hear. I saw it as a job. I saw it as a product that we're making, and I wanted to make that product as addicting and as, you know, good as possible, you know, by behaving in a certain way. And I think some people got that and some people didn't. And I think in reality, in actual reality, if you're filmed just being yourself with your friends, that is boring and the show will be cancelled. So I think providing we're having a good time making it, we had to figure out ways to entertain. Right. It's an
Absolutely,
entertainment
yeah.
show.
Yeah.
So,
and it was an award winning entertainment show as well.
I mean, winning a BAFTA was something that I never expected. In fact, Sarah Dillastone, who I love, you know, who was the exec producer of the show. And we had a marvelous relationship kind of from the very beginning. We just kind of understood that, you know, we could get mutually, you know, gain things from one another. Right. And we had an amazing working relationship and just understood what was necessary, right, for the show to be very popular. And she said to me kind of a day before the BAFTA, she was like, if we win the BAFTA, you should write, you should be the one to speak. And I said, yeah, but we're not going to win the BAFTA, so I wouldn't worry about it. And this is coming from the most confident bloke in the world. Yeah. But I couldn't for a single second imagine that, you know, this isn't a People's Choice BAFTA either. This is a BAFTA, like, you know, the Academy yeah. voted for this. So I was just thinking in the back of my mind, look, there's just no chance of this, right? Because I, and still have, you know, preconceived, you know, perceptions of shows like this, right? And I just mm-hmm. imagined that those would be amplified by those that sat on the Academy board and, you know, just figured we had no chance. Anyway, long story short, we obviously win the BAFTA, and I hadn't written anything, right? And, you know, this is back when I used to drink alcohol, and, you know, we'd had a lot to drink. And when we won, I was like, oh my God, I'm supposed to say something now. So you're kind of walking up to the, you know, stage at the BAFTAs, and can't even really remember. I just think I'd thanks everyone and just let everyone know. And looking back at it, you know, I wish I'd done a better job, but I think I mentioned how difficult, how time consuming and how much energy goes into creating a show like this, even though everyone just thinks that we turn up and film, you know, there's an awful lot that goes on. And anyway, I wish I hadn't said that, but whatever. So it's kind of, so we won a BAFTA and it was amazing. So you look, it's bittersweet for me, right? That show, because obviously it remains, you know, very popular. Looking back at it, do I wish I had behaved differently? Like, yes and no, because again, I don't think the show would have been popular without certain people being certain ways. Mm. And to be honest, it doesn't really stick, right? Like the title of Made in Chelsea sticks, But I'm not sure anyone really sees me in that way anymore. You know, it's been a very long time. You know, I have three beautiful kids with an amazing wife who I, you know, who is just my best friends. And you know, so it's, I'm quite sure people have made the distinction between that show and growing up. But still, you know, it's, I would never watch it back. You know, never.
Just, would you not? No, would it make you cringe?
Oh, forget it. I wouldn't be able to. And also, I never really watched it then, right? Because it's not, as I said, to me, like, of course the situations in the show are real. But to me, it was purely for entertainment purposes. I just never, I couldn't wrap my head around actually allowing people into my real life. Because the whole thing to me was a caricature.
And I mean, a lot of the, obviously you're doing things with Jamie all the time, but a lot of the original, that the original crew have had like quite a lot of big stuff going on in the last kind of year or so. Like, do you stay in touch with them? Do you reach out to them much?
I just trained with Jamie this morning. That's why I'm, so Jamie remains, you know, my best friend. I have, you know, two, three best friends in the world, you know, and I can count my friends on one hand. You know, I purposefully keep a pretty tight group. And Jamie is right up there. I love Jamie. Like, Jamie is so infectious. He's a brilliant person. He's hilarious. He's a very hard worker. And there's just so much to admire in Jamie. I haven't seen the rest of them in you know, at all, really. So
really, yeah,
no, it's not, it's kind of like
it was a moment in time.
Yeah, I see it as a job, right? It's kind of like I don't keep in touch with, you know, anyone really from ICAP when I was a forward foreign exchange broker. You know, I'm no longer a forward foreign exchange broker, so I don't see them anymore. You know, it's like many years ago I was a barman. Like, I don't keep in touch with them either, right? So it's kind of like, you know, I think I progress through life at my own pace and, you know, enjoy people, you know, along the way, with, you know, some people remaining close and others not. I think there's a lot of change. There's been so much change in my life that it's very difficult to keep constant with groups of people and friends. And, you know, one thing that I certainly found, you know, as I became far more sober for a start, far more driven, far busier, right, with CleanCo. Firstly, I have very little time to socialize, and I don't really miss it, right? So, like, so it's kind of so absorbed by what I'm doing and my family that actually going to the pub for 5 hours with 10 mates on a Sunday is just something that I'm not interested in currently, right? So I don't miss it because I feel that what we're doing is really meaningful. And I believe that we can make a difference to the lives of millions of people with what we're doing with CleanCo. So that supersedes any kind of social life that I might want at the moment. I'm not saying I have fun, right? I told you I have my, you know, friends, but it's every couple of weeks that we might get together and do something, you know, and it's a dinner type thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's so hard with three kids as well to just find the time to do that. So I'm impressed that you're doing that, to be honest.
There you go.
So let's chat about CleanCo. It's doing so incredibly well.
You're expecting a child as well, no?
I am, yeah. I've had nothing.
We must send you a case of our finest goods.
Oh, that would be amazing. It would be so nice to actually feel like, it's so nice to feel like you're still part of something. I think that's a really important part of what CleanCo has to offer, because you feel as though you are not disconnected from the social situation that you're taking part in.
Yeah. And listen, I'm very thankful that I'm a guest on your podcast, and we will go back to travel. But one thing that you will find, particularly nowadays with me, is that a lot of the things that I'm going to talk about later won't have happened or wouldn't have happened without sobriety and CleanCo. And for those of you that don't know what CleanCo is, just very quickly, you know, not to turn this into an advert, but just so that it makes sense, we make non-alcoholic spirit alternatives. So we have three gins, rum, whiskey coming out very soon, tequila, vodka, with no alcohol, you know, non-alcoholic liquids, and you mix them like you would mix an ordinary cocktail with, you know, their alcoholic counterpart, and you get the kind of full flavor and the ritual and experience of making yourself a cocktail without any of the negative, you know, repercussions of the alcohol. And we're not anti-alcohol, and I'm not anti-alcohol, but it was just to offer people a choice with very little compromise when it comes to making yourself a drink. So, you know, I feel like a gin and tonic, but I don't feel like drinking. Have a clean gin and tonic. Same, same. No alcohol.
So chapter three is the place where you learned the most about yourself.
Definitely the Sahara Desert.
What were you doing there?
So I did a quite a famous race called the Marathon des Sables.
Wow.
And that is it's a kind of 240 kilometer, like 6.5 marathon race across the Sahara, not the whole Sahara, of course, but a portion of the Sahara over 5 days. And it's quite brutal. And, you know, anyone who's done it will tell you that it's tough. And I think you know that it's tough going into it, but it's it certainly, for me, it was a really cathartic, you know, stripping you bare experience, where, of course, you learn a lot about yourself. We did it in October, which is the first time the race has ever been held in October. Because of COVID, it was delayed for 2 full years. And I think the race organizer just wanted to get the show back on the road. They've already announced that they will never, ever do it in October again, because the temperature was 10 degrees to 15 degrees hotter than it usually is. So we were running one day in 59 degrees C.
Oh, my God.
So about double the heat of a very hot holiday. To give you an example, St. Bart's in the height of summer is 30 degrees, 31 degrees.
Well, yeah, most of the people listening here in the UK will remember how we were like suffering when it was high 30s in that hit the heat wave here. So running an ultra marathon in that.
Yeah, so we were in 59 degrees, not all the time, but it was, you know, it was really full on. You know, there was a lot of sunstroke. There was a death. People have died before doing this race, but it hadn't happened in a while. Usually only about 5 to 10% of people drop out of the race. This year, 65% of people didn't make it. 840 started and only about 390 finished. I think, and it was really full on, right? Like it was just, you know, I don't think there was much comfort. And you know, I think the day that I learned the most about myself was probably day four. It's an 82.5 kilometer day, so it's a double marathon day. Obviously you've ran roughly a marathon a day the 3 days prior to this, you know, and then you've got a double marathon on the fourth day, and it was tough. Like that was really hard. and I can remember, oh, and also, by the way, so I didn't, my brother-in-law finds this the funniest thing about the whole thing, I didn't take earpods or any music or any podcasts or anything. So I was just, I didn't take my headphones because I didn't think that I was reading a lot about people saving weight and not taking anything. So I didn't have anything with me. And like everyone was listening to stuff or had music to pump them up, or like, I had nothing, right? So like, so this
the whistling of the desert wind.
It was just, yeah. So very long time to be alone with your thoughts, you know, not reading, not listening to anything, just alone. I think that day took me 14 hours and 20 minutes or something like that. You know, we started at 8:30. I think we finished at, you know, I think, I can't remember. It was very dark by the time we finished. And it was emotionally kind of pretty bruising that day, because, you know, runners listening to this will know that pretty difficult to run that in one go, let alone in the conditions that we're in the desert, you know, very sandy. Sand's not hard at all because there's been no water whatsoever. So it's just very soft sand, you know, for most of it. And yeah, I just remember thinking about my wife, my kids a lot, but also just, you know, slowly getting from checkpoint to checkpoint. And, you know, by the time the sun went down and it, you know, started to get cool and it was pitch black and you're, you know, fishing around for your headlamp so that you can even see, you know, in front of you, I had 30 kilometers left, I think, you know, and it's just like, and it's just long, 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 long. And you realize that, and Nims Persia from 14 Peaks is a good friend of mine, said this in his film, you know, when you think you're effed, you're only about 40% effed, right? Like, oh, I can't quite remember what he said, but you know, he basically makes you know, so when you feel like you simply cannot go any further, that is nonsense. You're not even halfway, right? You can push yourself. Mm-hmm. Like the human body and the human mind is very capable of taking a lot more than you think it can. So yeah, look, I mean, there's no option as well. Like, you can leave, of course. You've got a button you can press on your pack that calls a helicopter and choppers you out of the desert. You don't want to be doing.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb. It has been a long old winter here in the UK, and in between podcast seasons, I'm going to take a little bit of downtime to seek out some warmth. I'm jetting off to the Greek island of Mykonos, visiting some places that have been on my bucket list. And while I'm hopefully soaking up some Mediterranean sun, my home will be hosting guests from all over the world thanks to Airbnb. It's the perfect way to make your travels even more rewarding. Instead of letting your home sit empty while you're off exploring new destinations, why not turn it into a cozy retreat for fellow travelers, just like I do? Whether you choose to rent out your entire space or just a spare room, it's up to you. I list my spare bedroom, and it's been a fantastic experience, both financially rewarding and a great way to connect with new people. So if you're planning your own summer getaway, or any trip for that matter, consider putting your home on Airbnb. It's a fantastic way to earn extra income that can go towards your travel expenses, souvenirs, or even that special treat you've been eyeing. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb for supporting the Travel Diaries.
Wow, I mean, what a thing to go through. And interesting, actually, that you mentioned NIMS as somebody who gave you some advice that kept me motivated, because I know that you've teamed up with him recently on a really important and exciting new project that you've got coming up.
Yeah, so, I mean, since I was young, I've wanted to do what we just did. You know, never thought that we'd have Disney as a partner or anything like that, and you know, have always been unclear as to how to go about this. But for several years now, there's been I've been kind of aching to understand more about my brother Michael's death. He was the youngest Brit to reach the summit of Mount Everest back in 1999, age 22. He's very different to me, so that's not why he did it. he was an incredibly modest, thoughtful, kind kid, very talented, amazing, you know, trader, broker, just a very interesting, well-rounded person. And his life was lost on Everest. I was 10 at the time. And always just remember thinking it was, you know, very unfair, you know, as any kind of kid might, you know, hold resentment towards the death of a loved one. You know, I never really processed it fully. I always believed that I'd kind of see him again. I never really took it on the chin that he had died. I remember thinking it was impossible at the time, that Mike is, you know, the strongest, the best, you know, that this is some kind of mistake. And as such, it never crushed me in the way that it, you know, affected my parents and, you know, brother, obviously, who were older than me and understood the reality of the situation far faster and easier than I did. Mm-hmm. And we would read, you know, that bodies could be recovered from Everest now. You know, I think you can, well, it's not, I think, sorry, I know now, you can fly helicopters into Camp 2. For people that are unfamiliar with Everest, that's quite a big deal. Essentially, there's, you know, from base camp, there's then the Khumbu Icefall leading up to Camp 1. And then Camp 2 is at the end of a kind of some degree of altitude, but long kind of plain right at the base of what you would think was, you know, the beginning of the climb, essentially, you know, and it's, it makes it easier to, you know, bring bodies down. I mean, it's not easy, but bringing bodies down the mountain, you know, requires a lot of manpower, but getting them to camp two can be done. And then of course you can helicopter out of there. So it's kind of, my mind would just race in that, well, you know, we need to get Mike off the mountain. And I've always been uncomfortable with the idea of him being up there, you know, possibly in plain sight. You know, a lot of people climb Everest nowadays. I think 600 people a year summit Everest. And was always quite uncomfortable that he could just be laying up there, you know, as like some kind of tourist attraction. You know, But also kind of on his own, you know, away from us, he obviously died up there. His last thoughts were probably about how he's never going to see his family again. And I don't know, I've always been uncomfortable with him being up there. I've always wanted to bring him home.
To have that closure.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we had a memorial service, but we were, of course, never able to see his body and, you know, have not seen him in 23 years. Set out to go to Everest and to try and find him and bring him home. And we made a documentary feature film about it. And it's called Finding Michael. And it'll be out in February of 2023. And we're, you know, I want my brother to have some kind of legacy for his, you know, his bravery at the time. Not so much that people just know his name, but that, you know, that we can then use his name and legacy to do more good than we currently do. So we have a foundation called the Michael Matthews Foundation. And we look after about 5,000 kids in Africa, and we house them and feed them and educate them. You know, that we build boarding schools, essentially. And although it's great, I'd love to do more, and I'd love to grow that to help, you know, as many kids as possible, not necessarily only in Africa. I'd like to do some stuff here as well. And I think it's, you know, it's very difficult to get any kind of traction with stuff like this. You know, it's, you know, for example, running the Marathon des Sables, you know, doing the Ice Ultra, I've ran 5 marathons before all of this. And you do a number of things to raise money. And of course, you know, we can be quite successful in fundraising, but not to the level to make an actual difference, you know, long-lasting change. And I'd like Mike's name to be used for that, and I know that he would be proud of that. So I guess I'm hoping that people watch the film, get to know him a bit, understand what he went through, and want to help, right? Because I think it would be a nice thing to be able to do more good, however that may come.
Well, that's a really beautiful thing to do, and yeah, I really look forward to seeing how the experience played out, because I know that for whether you're, you know, you were dealing with going through, I imagine, a huge amount of a lifetime of emotion, working through that in an extreme environment. But for anybody who is in that kind of environment, whether they're dealing with something like that or not, it's another place where you learn a lot about yourself, isn't it?
Yeah, well, this would have been a good answer for the previous question, I guess, as well. I mean, for those who have not trekked to Everest Base Camp, please do it. It is so spellbindingly beautiful. It is so cool, the trek. And you don't need to be Superman or Superwoman to do it either. You're fine. You know, you'll hear a lot of people say that it's really difficult. I'm sure it can be, but you'll be fine. Trust me, it's all right. And it is so cool, right? And like, there's this somewhere that will always stick with me is this little town called Namche Bazaar. You just don't expect it at all. By this stage, you're already up in the clouds, right? You've been walking for days. You're above cloud level. So, right. You know, past a certain point in the day, the cloud becomes thick. Well, certainly the weather that we had, the cloud became thick, and you're looking down at thick cloud. So you're up in the sky, right? And you turn like this corner and you come across this town, but it's like a full on town in the sky,
in the
right?
Clouds.
And it's amazing. It's like, it reminded me of kind of like, I love Thor in the MCU and stuff. It reminded me of kind of like Asgard. It's just middle of nowhere, up in the mountains, so far away from anything. I think you're 40 miles away from the nearest actual town. No roads, no cars. You can only walk in and out. So you're miles away from like any other civilization. There's schools there's bars, coffee shops, pizzerias. And it's just like, I found it so amazing. You're really high altitude as well at this point. I think you're above the summit of Mont Blanc by this stage.
Wow, right.
It's kind of like you're really up and in it, and it's kind of like walking upstairs quickly at this stage is like, I'm pretty fit. I love sport. Takes your breath away walking up a flight of stairs. You know, you will feel tired from doing that. And it's just, yeah, I remember it just being so charming, and like all of these colorful little roofs everywhere, and kind of just over the years, people have walked in with bricks and, you know, materials to build this town on ox back and on horseback and carrying it themselves. You know, we lift weights in the gym, like Jamie and I. These guys carry, like this one guy walked past us and he was carrying like 150 kilos of gear on his back on this big wooden thing. And it's just like,
nuts.
You wouldn't get 10 meters with that thing on your back. And like, I was twice the size of this bloke, and I was just like, God, it's amazing. So anyway, so they also, of course, can helicopter in stuff, but that's, you know, very expensive up there. So it's kind of, I find it kind of amazing. And like, you're told not to eat certain things because you would see like somebody walking in with meat, like a, you know, a dead goat, for example. And like, it would just be covered in fly. It would just look like obviously kind of inedible. And the guy would say, that's going up to Namche and it'll be served as kind of goat curry. So make sure you don't have the goat curry. And it's like, you know, the bloke's been walking for 6 days to get it there with no refrigeration, right? So it's kind of, I don't know, I found the whole thing to just be so interesting. And yeah. I had the good fortune of, you know, Bear Grylls is involved in the project as well. And has, of course, done Everest. He became the youngest when he summited a year after Mike, because he was a year older than Mike. So he stepped into Mike's record as such, which, you know, obviously you couldn't wish it for a better bloke. I love Bear so much. He's just such a legend, and he's exactly how you'd imagine him to be. He's exactly how you think he would be. Just perfect, so cool. And we did some filming for this, so he's in the film. He's also a producer of the film. And I called him when I was in Namche, and we just had a really good FaceTime catch up about Namche, and because he's familiar with it, and he just loves it there as well. He just thinks it's so interesting and exciting, and it is. It's like it's unbelievable, honestly. Like it's, I struggle to explain it, but I can't wait for that. I can't wait for that moment in the film where we come around the corner and see Namche, because it's just like, what is this doing here?
Surreal.
Like it's amazing. We had a pizza; it was delicious. Like we went out for pizza, and I don't drink, but like everyone was having beers and. You know, we were playing pool in a pool bar, the same pool bar that Mike was in, you know, and it was just really amazing. Like, you know, part of the film is that we retrace the exact steps that Mike and his friends took 23 years ago. So, you know, we stay in the same places and do the same path and, you know, experience the same things. And it was, I think it'll be a really powerful, amazing film. And I honestly, I've kind of never looked forward to something more, because I'm so eager for people to see it, because nothing to do with me. Like I just want people to see it and understand it. It was the most kind of meaningful moment of my life, you know, filming this thing. We went and filmed this 5 days after Otto was born.
So 5 days. Wow.
Yeah, I was away for 5.5 weeks, which was really hard, right? Like, you know, I love my kids. But, you know, the climbers who listen to this, or, you know, anyone who knows about Everest will know that there's very specific weather windows.
Yeah.
Where you can climb Everest, and you know, we had to, it was either Otto's born and, you know, we'll push the whole thing back a year, or we'll just do it, you know, now, because we're ready. So, you know, it was a tough decision, but my wife is just the coolest, like, woman in the world. And she said, look, if it was me, I would do it, right? So that's, she's like, if the shoe was on the other, she's incredibly.
You guys have an amazing relationship.
We're very lucky, and we do. It's, you know, we you know, every so often try and remind ourselves of that. But it's we're very fortunate, I think. Well, I'm certainly very fortunate to have her, and I hope she feels the same way. Mm. But she's yeah, you know, she's always felt incredibly close to Mike. Obviously, she's never met him, but, you know, we have photos of Mike around the house, and, you know, I've never felt closer to Mike than filming this. Obviously, and yeah. You know, I'm going to slip and give stuff away if I carry on, but please watch the film. Because it's a really powerful tale of brotherly love.
Incredible. Thank you so much for sharing about that incredibly meaningful experience. I really look forward to watching the documentary. So let's move on now to the big chapter, chapter 4, your all-time favorite destination, Spencer. Where comes to mind today?
All-time favorite destination. It's such a tough one, because obviously, you know, the world is full of the most incredible places. We love New York. I say we, like, my wife and I love New York. Of course, St. Bart's gets a mention, south of France. I think Italy has so much to offer. I really enjoyed my time in Australia when I was there. South Africa, you know, it's very difficult to honestly put a pin on it. California, you know, I went to university in California. It's just, I loved it. I'm pretty easy kind of anywhere, to be honest. I'm not, I'm really comfortable in most places. I don't need, you know, huge amount, you know, like I honestly took, like, I would do the Marathon des Sables again, right? Because I just loved it. Like, I just found the whole thing to be so powerful, and I loved the experience of doing it. And then, you know, you go to St. Bart's, you stay at the Eden Rock. It's totally different, but it's yeah. but there's joy in both things, right? And one is kind of more meaningful almost than the other, but one holds a more special place in your heart, I guess. But yeah, you know, I guess. Sorry, I'm just dancing around your point.
I have another question, actually, though. As somebody who grew up in a hotel and knows, like, the ins and outs of, like, what really makes a good hotel, which you must have really got quite a keen eye for now, aside from Eden Rock, then, is there one that you really feel, like, comes to mind as, like, nailing what the perfect hotel is?
I can be a real hotel snob. Not in like a, not in a kind of like, well, I'm never coming back here again. But, like, I do feel that detail is so important, right? Yeah. Like, little details.
Yeah.
I think hotels obviously come in so many different shapes and sizes. We've stayed at a beautiful place called the Palais Namaskar in Morocco, as well, which is kind of literally in the middle of nowhere, but so grand and interesting and kind of beautiful, right? And, like, spacious. And you wander the grounds of the hotel and you feel like you're kind of almost in a small version of the Taj Mahal type thing. It's just a great big thing, which I'm sure some people would really love, and, you know, others might not, but I enjoyed my stay there. In New York, we stayed at a hotel called The Mark. I love the Bowery. You know, they're all very different, right? The Bowery is just kind of rich with heritage as well. You know, lots of kind of dark woods and, you know, interesting part of town. And it's just, you know, lots of interesting people floating in and out of the Bowery. You know, it's kind of a cool place.
People watching.
Yeah, it's a cool place. It's a great place to people watch. I couldn't care less about, you know, celebrities or whatever. Well, I say that, I've got a podcast where we literally track down celebrities, but I think that was Jamie's idea. No, but it's just, you know, I was in the Bowery recently. I was in New York on business for 4 days last week, and I was in the Bowery, and kind of, you know, Jared Leto waltzes in and goes up to his room, and then who else was there? I saw loads of kind of interesting people, and, you know, it's just good fun, right? If you like that type of thing. But also the rooms are great, service is great. There's this amazing guy called Leo who kind of, you know, runs a ship, big bearded guy, is fantastic. So I think a lot of good hotels are made by the kind of management and the people who work there and the kind of experience that you have, right? At the end of the day, you know, are you spending loads of time in your hotel room, or is it more just the experience of being in that particular part of the world that you're after? You know, I don't know. I typically don't spend much time in my hotel room. So do I care if I have some whopping great big suite or some small room, you know, as long as it has a bed and a shower, I don't really care. You know, I'm not going to be in the room at all. You know, give me a beach and a sun lounger anywhere. And, you know, I'm not going to be in the room.
You're happy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, Chapter 5 is your hidden gem, and that is a place that you love that maybe my listeners wouldn't know so much about.
Okay. Can it be a restaurant?
Yeah, it can be anything.
Okay, I'm going to give you two restaurants. One's really low end but fantastic, and one's really high end and fantastic. So
awesome.
Both in New York. So Katz Deli in New York is where they filmed that famous When Harry Met Sally scene where she has the orgasm in the restaurant. That's in Katz Deli. And they make a Reuben's sandwich. And it is just, well, I've got another one after this. And it is just like, it's alarmingly delicious. You'll pay quite a lot.
Orgasmically delicious.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. That's what she was eating, I think, at the time of the orgasm. So it's kind of, you know, it's got its gherkins and the salt beef and kind of all kinds of other stuff. It's the size of kind of two fists, you know, and it's just... Honestly, my wife is just outrageously jealous when I go to New York because she knows I'm going to go straight to Katz Deli. and it's honestly just completely delicious. I mean, the experience of being in Katz is just whatever, right? But that particular sandwich is amazing. And also, if we're just going to, on a very similar path to that, there's a little place, tiny place. It's been around, you know, long before I was born. I think it was erected in the either 50s or 60s. Called the Select Burger. The chef there, who's unfortunately passed away now, was called Marius, and they make this Marius special double cheeseburger with bacon. And it is just, there's nothing special about it, by the way, but it's just, I don't know what it is. It's not special, you know, fancy brioche bun. It's not special bacon. There's nothing special about it, but the way in which it's honestly, I think I've had four of those in a day before, just because you just can't get enough of them. So there's that. That's a hidden gem as well. And then on the more high end side of things, I was lucky enough to be treated to dinner by a good friend of mine in New York the other night at a restaurant called Four Charles.
The
number four Charles. Let me tell you something. You wouldn't want to eat there every night. I suspect you wouldn't survive the year. But it's again, they do a bacon cheeseburger that you kind of cut in quarters and have that as like a starter. And then they bring out this. Oh my goodness! They bring out these kind of crab claws diced up in the shell. Yeah, yeah. Oh. Delicious sauce. You just drench it in. Then they're known for the porterhouse beef, and I think, if my MasterChef days serve me correctly, that it's boiled or broiled and then seared, because it's like so consistently pink the whole way through. Great big piece of meat, and it's kind of diced quite thinly. They call it the English cut actually, because they serve it like you would have roast beef, and it's just like it just melts in your mouth. It's so delicious. And then they bring you this porterhouse like sandwich that you drench in this sauce. It's a really high-end restaurant, but it serves a bunch of stuff that, you know, you wouldn't expect to be.
Sounds like mouth-watering.
It's amazing. It's like proper amazing. I love food. Oh. If you haven't already noticed, I just adore good food. And then there's, god, what else did they bring that was delicious? Creamy delicious creamed spinach with like roasted cheese on the top, and like macaroni cheese and all these sauces. Anyway, so that if you're in New York and you can get yourself, I think I heard somewhere there's an 18-month waiting list, which is,
oh,
you know,
wow.
Great. Well, my friend weasels his way in all kinds of places. I don't really know how he does it, to be honest, but we were lucky enough to get a table. But for Charles, if you're in New York or you're going to New York in the future, book it.
100%.
It is. Yeah, yeah.
It sold me.
It's just, it was wildly delicious.
Oh my God, it sounds amazing.
Yeah, okay, it was great.
Great, great tip. Thanks so much, Spencer. Yeah. Right, our penultimate chapter then.
Excellent.
Chapter 6 is your worst travel experience?
I got a bit ahead of myself when I was fortunate enough to do well in the Marathon de Sable. I came 69th overall. And I thought, well, I can do anything now. And I signed up to another one, like almost immediately. 250 kilometers, 5 days, same thing, Arctic Sweden, up in the middle of nowhere. So I heard it's, you know, minus 36, two and a half thousand meters of incline, big like snowshoes, so super slow, and, you know, sleeping rough on like reindeer hides. And I just thought, yeah, you know, I've done the mental heat one. I'll do the cold one. That was the worst. That day one was the, so compare it with kind of day one in the desert. That's of course tough, but you're running and you've got, you know, people around you and you're getting to know people and you're enjoying it and you're not pushing yourself to the absolute limit that you collapse because you know you've got 5 days of it. So you're actually having a good time. This was not a good time. So this was just horrific. So I got to the top of the mountain on day one and I took my glove off to take a selfie at the top of the mountain. Cause it was, I mean, again, nothing against Arctic Sweden, one of the most beautiful places I've ever been, but just rough, this race. And I got to the top and my hand didn't recover for the whole day. Like just, it was only out for 20 seconds and it was just effed for the whole day. I couldn't get sensation back in my hand. I couldn't eat properly. The first day was 61 kilometers, something like that. And we got to the end and just like, you think you'd be happy to get to the end. You're just not. Yeah. You're just really angry, like really angry. I had a really bad cough and I was just incredibly uncomfortable. Didn't sleep very well. Lots of people left after the first night of this one. It was honestly, it was so rough. I can't even tell. It was just hideous. And also because the people in front of you are faster and the people below you are slower, you're on your own for the whole thing, right? So like I was, because it's kind of a single file thing, because there's the path that's been dredged for you. So it's like there's no camaraderie whatsoever, right? You're not chatting to anyone. You're on your own. Again, listening to nothing. And like 4 or 5 hours into the first day, when you realize you've got another 10 hours, you're just like, I'm not having a good time doing this at all. Like, this is shit. I hate it. And that's just in your head. It's like, I'm not, like, there is no point in me doing this. Like, I'm on my own. I may as well be in the middle of Arctic Sweden on my own, because that's what's happening. Yeah. And like, you get to the end. And anyway, yeah, so I didn't have fun at all. I really hated it. I would never do that race again. Went into day two almost reluctantly. I just thought to myself, well, I can't. I was raising money again for the Michael Matthews Foundation. I was like, well, I can't kind of pull the ripcord. Although lots of people, literally, like, I think 100 people like left on day one. And it was kind of like, okay, like, this is a really, really hard thing to do. And I, just went into day two. Cough got worse. Starts to feel quite feverish. But we'd done the two really hard days. Then the rest of it was flat. Tested me for COVID and I had COVID. So I'd essentially done the first 2 days with COVID. I didn't know that I had COVID. God.
Oh my God. I can't believe that you did that with COVID as well.
So I'd done 105 kilometers at this stage with in minus 36 with 2.5K of incline. And I didn't feel myself, right? I was a bit angry and a bit pissed off like the whole time, which is unusual for me. I'm quite a positive person. And yeah, tested me for COVID. And I was like, well, we're literally in the middle of nowhere. So because I didn't feel terrible. I didn't feel great, right? But I could have easily carried on. And I just said, look, can I have a separate start time to everyone else? Like if I leave an hour after the last person, then I'll be on my own. I've been isolated anyway running this thing, so I'll remain isolated for the rest of it. And they were just like, we can't send you into these conditions knowing that you have COVID. And I was just like, well, I have been running for the last 2 days, so shouldn't make too much difference. And they were just like, no, what you don't understand is, or what you probably haven't thought about, is COVID is a like respiratory thing. If you have proper COVID and you go up these mountains in these low temperatures, it can cause serious damage to your lungs. So I stayed on my own then for a few days in the middle of Arctic Sweden to isolate before I tested negative and flew home. But yeah, you won't catch me up there again, I don't think.
God, what an unbelievable experience. Yeah, maybe one to consign to the history books.
Yes.
We are now then on to the final chapter of your travel diary, Spencer. Chapter 7, the destination that is at the top of your travel bucket list. Where have you not been that you're desperate to go to?
I'd love to do more traveling. I think with really young kids, it's quite difficult. But as a family, we're keen to travel together. I think when Otto's 3 or 4 and the rest of them are a bit more grown up, I think that would be a great time to do kind of annual trips together. I'd love to go to Japan. I'm fascinated by Japan. I love sushi, but that's not why I want to go to Japan. I think it would just be like a fantastic experience. My parents went quite recently and said it was just great. I would love to do South America, which I've never been to, kind of Argentina, I think would be fantastic. I know that Mike had a wonderful experience climbing Aconcagua in Argentina. I'd love to go to Argentina. I'd love to go to Brazil. I haven't been to Brazil either. So I've kind of, for somebody that's done a fair amount, I feel like I have kind of stuck to what I know a bit, and I would love to expand my kind of knowledge and horizons, and do more traveling, just not in Arctic Sweden.
Oh, thank you so much, Spencer Matthews. Those were your travel diaries. It has been so much fun chatting to you today. Thank you for giving us all the wanderlust.
Thanks so much. A great pleasure. And yeah, you were brilliant. Thank you.
Oh, a massive thank you to Spencer Matthews for such an honest conversation in so many ways. He is such a lovely guy. If you'd like to hear more from Spencer and his wife, Vogue, you can tune into their hit podcast, Spencer and Vogue, a global original. And don't forget to check out his low and no alcohol drinks brand, CleanCo. And with that, it's a wrap for season 8. Thank you so much for tuning in each week, everyone, and for spreading the word. It's been a really wonderful season, thanks to some fantastic guests and, of course, your support too. And a memorable one for me, the last one before I have a baby. I've been pregnant the whole time recording this season, so I'll look back at it probably very fondly, I hope, but with mixed feelings, because I was very nauseous through some of these interviews that you've been listening to as well. I'll be back in early spring. The gap between this season and next will probably be a little longer than usual, as I'll be taking some time off as maternity leave. But do stay in touch in the meantime over on Instagram. I'm at Holly Rubenstein. I'll be posting updates about the podcast and probably about family travel too over there, if you're interested, all being well. And if you can't wait until next year, remember there are over 90 episodes of the podcast to catch up on now or to revisit. I love revisiting old episodes of podcasts I like. So yeah, they're all there if you want to listen. A huge thank you again, everyone, and I will speak to you soon. Take care. Today's episode is supported by Airbnb. It has been a long old winter here in the UK, and in between podcast seasons, I'm going to take a little bit of downtime to seek out some warmth. I'm jetting off to the Greek island of Mykonos, visiting some places that have been on my bucket list. And while I'm hopefully soaking up some Mediterranean sun, my home will be hosting guests from all over the world, thanks to Airbnb. It's the perfect way to make your travels even more rewarding. Instead of letting your home sit empty while you're off exploring new destinations, why not turn it into a cozy retreat for fellow travelers, just like I do? Whether you choose to rent out your entire space or just a spare room, it's up to you. I list my spare bedroom, and it's been a fantastic experience, both financially rewarding and a great way to connect with new people. So if you're planning your own summer getaway, or any trip for that matter, consider putting your home on Airbnb. It's a fantastic way to earn extra income that can go towards your travel expenses, souvenirs, or even that special treat you've been eyeing. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb for supporting the Travel Diaries.
Hold up.
What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.